RN, your world unfolding.
Hello, I'm Paul Barclay. You're with Big Ideas on RN or online at abc.net.au. Adolescence is a period of heightened risk-taking and reckless behaviour. Drinking, drug-taking, unprotected sex, even criminal activity. But why are teenagers so vulnerable to these risks? Tonight, one of the world's foremost authorities on adolescent psychological development, Lawrence Steinberg, discusses the underpinnings of adolescent risk-taking, informed by recent advances in developmental neuroscience. Essentially, the cause is an imbalance between reward-seeking and cognitive self-control. Recent research on adolescent brain development shows these two mental conditions have different neural underpinnings and develop according to different timetables. While adolescents have a need to seek rewards, their capacity for self-control is still maturing. So what are the implications of this imbalance on strategies to mitigate youth risk-taking? And what role does peer pressure play on risk-taking? Lawrence Steinberg is the Distinguished University Professor and Laura H. Carnell Professor of Psychology at Temple University. His talk is part of the Sulzberger Distinguished Lecture Series at Duke University.
Risk-taking in adolescence is very common and it's pervasive. So compared to adults, adolescents commit more crimes. The age crime curve, it shows that violent crime and property crime both peak in the late teen years. This is a very robust pattern that is seen across historical time and across industrialized societies as well. Adolescents, as I'm sure most of you probably know, have more car crashes. This pattern holds even when you control for driving experience, so that an inexperienced 17-year-old driver is more likely to have a crash than an equally inexperienced 20 or 21-year-old driver. But here are some findings that you're probably not as familiar with. Compared to adults, adolescents drown more often, which is surprising because adolescents generally are pretty strong. But these are data from the CDC on unintentional drownings, which also peak at around the same point in time. I think given what we know about the strength of adolescents, that we can assume that they're not drowning for lack of endurance, but for lack of good judgment, probably. They attempt suicide more often. These are data also from the CDC on non-fatal self-inflicted injuries. And I hope that you're starting to see a pattern here about when these different kinds of risk-taking tend to peak. They're more likely to begin experimenting with drugs than adults. The age of onset of illicit drug abuse or dependence also showing a pattern that is quite similar. And what the point that I want to make here is that these are very different kinds of behaviors: drowning, drug use, automobile crashes, crime, and so forth. It's also the case that adolescents have more unintended pregnancies. Again, you see that peak falling at around the same point in time. And so it's, I think, a challenge to try to come up with an explanation for why these very different kinds of behaviors would all follow an age pattern where they increase coming into adolescence, peak sometime during the mid or late adolescent years, and then fall. So adolescence is always virtually, across all different types of risk behaviors, the most risky time in human development. And the major contributors to morbidity and mortality during adolescence are not illness or disease, they're behavioral in nature, and a lot of these behaviors in particular. Adolescence is also the most common age of onset for major psychiatric disorders. If you take any major psychiatric disorder and you look at the average age of onset, some have a very wide range, some have a very narrow range, but adolescence is always in that range for virtually all of them. So it's also a very vulnerable period, as well as a period of heightened risk behavior. Well, psychologists have been studying adolescent risk-taking for quite some time, and we've managed to generate a lot of myths about adolescent risk-taking that have not held up to empirical scrutiny. It had been once proposed that adolescents are illogical, but studies of logical reasoning show that those abilities improve until about age 15 or 16 and then hit a plateau, and 15 and 16-year-olds are no less capable in logical reasoning than adults. Some people propose that adolescents underestimate risk, but it's studies that give individuals lists of risky or dangerous activities and ask people to estimate the chances of something bad happening if you engage in it find that adolescents actually overestimate risk, as do adults, but adolescents overestimate it even more than adults do. So that can't explain their engagement in risky behavior. I was taught when I was at Vassar and at Cornell that adolescents believe that they're invulnerable, that they suffer from the personal fable, as it's referred to. And that turns out to be true, except so do adults. And there aren't age differences in delusions of invulnerability. When the field shifted away from a Piagetian approach to adolescent cognitive development to a more information processing approach, people studied whether adolescents think poorly when making decisions. That is, not only do they make poor decisions, but they think poorly when they're making them. But studies of information processing abilities show that they follow a similar developmental pattern to those for logical reasoning. They improve, they hit a plateau at around 16 or so, and adolescents' information processing capabilities by the time they're in that age period are no worse than those of adults. And then some people have said, I think kind of surprisingly, that adolescents are unaware of the dangers associated with risky behavior. I say surprisingly because about somewhere, depending upon the particular type of education, between 95 and 99% of adolescents in the United States get education in schools in which they're told about the risks of various behaviors that adults are trying to prevent. So it seems highly unlikely that they're unaware of the dangers associated with risky behaviors. And studies find, in fact, that there are no age differences in people's awareness of the dangers of these different kinds of behaviors once you reach middle adolescence. So the question that has been driving our research for such a long time is one that I think perplexes many parents as well as researchers, which is that if on all these measures of intellectual functioning, adolescents are so smart, why do they do all these stupid things? One place where we might look for an answer is in the teen brain. And the science of adolescent brain development is relatively new. The first studies that showed systematic changes in the adolescent brain didn't come out until the late 1990s, and those were structural brain imaging studies. Functional brain imaging studies on adolescent development came out even after that. So this is a really, really young field, but amazing, I think, progress has been made in a very, very short period of time. So for those of you not familiar with the neuroscience of adolescence, I just want to give you a very, very quick course in this and talk about some general principles of adolescent brain development. Adolescence appears to be a period of heightened brain plasticity, a period when the brain is especially sensitive to environmental influence. We now also understand that brain maturation continues until a much later age than previously believed. People thought that because the brain reaches its full adult size by the time people are around 10 or so, that there wasn't brain development going on after that. But it turns out that even though in many ways adolescents' brains look like adults' brains, they don't function like adults' brains. And brain maturation, especially functional maturation, is going on well into the early 20s and probably beyond. We also know that different brain systems mature at different points in time and at different rates. A question that I'm very frequently asked when I talk in the policy arena is when does the adolescent brain become the adult brain? And it really depends on what part of the brain and what aspect of brain functioning one is talking about. Some of it is already mature by the time teenagers are 14 or 15 years old. Other brain systems are still maturing in the early and mid-20s. The point, and if there's a take-home message of this talk, this is what I'd like you to remember, is that the different timetables of different brain regions creates unique characteristics of adolescence and helps to explain adolescent risk-taking as well, I think. So the main brain regions showing change in adolescence are the prefrontal cortex and the limbic system. The prefrontal cortex is the area behind your forehead. It's a part of the frontal lobe. And the fact that the prefrontal cortex is maturing is important to understand in our description of adolescent behavior. So adolescents are less likely than adults to consider the future consequences of their actions. I'm sure most of you know here that the prefrontal cortex is kind of the CEO of the brain. It's the part of the brain that's mainly responsible for governing executive function and higher order cognitive abilities and self-regulation. Adolescents are less likely than adults to plan ahead. They're less able than adults to control their impulses, and they're less able than adults to simultaneously consider the risks and rewards of a decision. Now, notice that in all of these things, I didn't say that they're not able to do these things. The point is that they're less able than adults are to do these things. The other system that is undergoing important development during adolescence is the limbic system. This is a system of the brain that is deep inside the brain. It's very important for the processing of reward and punishment and for processing of emotional and social information. The limbic system undergoes a period of heightened arousal in adolescence around the time of puberty, and we're now beginning to understand the impact that sex hormones have on brain functioning and to link the impact of specific sex hormones, testosterone in particular, on activity in the limbic system. One consequence of this arousal is that adolescents experience higher highs and lower lows than adults do. Adolescents are not necessarily more moody than adults, which is the stereotype. It's more that their moods are more intense than adults are, which often gives the appearance of being moodier. Adolescents are especially sensitive to emotional cues because this system is so easily aroused. Some of you who are parents may relate to this. I can remember when our son was a teenager, and if he had done something that I wasn't particularly pleased with, I might say to him, "Can we discuss this and why you made that choice?" And he would say, "Stop yelling at me." And I think it's because he's picking up on an emotional cue that I'm not even aware that I'm sending out, and that might not even strike an adult as noticeable. They're especially sensitive to social information. We now understand that network in the brain that is often referred to as the social brain undergoes important development during adolescence, but adolescents are very aware of social cues and pay attention to them. This helps to explain things like susceptibility to peer influence, adolescents' special concern with their social standing and with the opinions of other people and what other people are thinking of them. And they're especially sensitive to rewards, which is a major theme in the research that we've been doing. In neuroimaging studies in which people of different ages are presented with rewarding stimuli, like piles of coins or smiling faces, adolescents' reward centers are more active than are the reward centers of children or adults. And that's been shown in a number of different studies. To the point, though, is that the differential timing of prefrontal development and the arousal of the limbic system is very, very important. Because the arousal of the limbic system occurs early in adolescence, as I said, around the time of puberty and because of puberty. But the maturation of the prefrontal cortex is very gradual and still ongoing well into the 20s. And so the metaphor that many of us have used to describe this is like starting the engine before a good braking system is in place. So I want to talk about the first study that we did that looked at this. This is a study that was funded by the MacArthur Foundation under the aegis of the Research Network on Adolescent Development and Juvenile Justice. We did that study because we were interested in questions of juvenile culpability. We were interested in how we judge adolescents' criminal responsibility. And some of you may know that in American criminal law, the extent to which you're punished for a criminal act is related to the extent to which you're seen as responsible for that act. So, for example, premeditated crimes tend to be punished more harshly than impulsive ones because premeditation implies a greater responsibility for the act. Crimes that you're coerced into committing are punished less harshly than crimes that you seem to do willingly and under your own volition. We were interested in the MacArthur study in understanding whether certain capacities that affect our judgments of criminal responsibility develop during the adolescent years. So if, for example, adolescents are less able to control their impulses than adults, then they may be inherently less responsible for their criminal behavior. And that's the argument that my colleagues and I made in the briefs that we prepared in those Supreme Court cases. So in the juvenile capacity study, we looked at age differences in capacities that affect judgment and decision making. And we focused on reward seeking and self-control. And we studied 935 individuals sampled in five different locations around the country between the ages of 10 and 30. And the sample was socioeconomically and ethnically diverse. Importantly, the age groups were matched. They were on IQ and gender and ethnicity and socioeconomic status. So any age differences that you're about to see are not due to demographic differences between the groups. The individuals were all sampled from the same communities that is within each region. So if we look at self-report measure of sensation seeking, which is very related to reward seeking, we see a pattern in which there's an increase in self-reported sensation seeking during the beginning of adolescence and then a general decline after that. Now, in this study, we didn't simply rely on self-report measures. We also administered a series of behavioral tasks as well. Risk preference follows a similar inverted U-shaped curve. When we ask individuals to tell us whether particular activities are risky, we don't see age differences in them. But when we ask them how to evaluate the rewards and costs of risky activities, we do see this age pattern. So we asked about things like unprotected sex, riding in a car being driven by somebody who's been drinking, smoking cigarettes, shoplifting, and so forth. So it's not that adolescents don't think of these things as risky behavior. It's just that in their evaluation of the rewards and costs of engaging in the act, they differ from adults. One of our behavioral measures of reward processing is the Iowa gambling task. In the Iowa gambling task, the subject is presented with four decks of cards, and they're told that two of the decks are good and two of the decks are bad. And when you flip over a card from any of the decks, you receive information about whether you've won or lost and how much, if so. And the way that we do this task is we administer it in three blocks of 40 trials. So individuals are turning over 120 cards. And you're told that your goal is to maximize your winnings by choosing from the correct decks. Now, in this study, and in all the studies I'm going to tell you about today, the subjects are all paid $35 for participating in the study, and they're promised a bonus of $15 if they do well. Now, we never define what doing well is, but we do this to incentivize them to try to do their best on these tasks because they're given certain goals to strive for, like maximizing their winning. And everybody gets the bonus. Now, I mentioned that some of the decks are good, two of them, and two of them are bad. The best way I can describe what they're like is if any of you have ever been to a casino and played blackjack, this is what the bad decks are like. Every once in a while, you get a really good win. You get a really good card. But the deck is calibrated so that if you keep playing from that deck over time, just as if you keep staying at the blackjack table over time, you're going to lose money. But some people really like that feeling of getting that big win every once in a while. The good decks have far less exciting wins, but they're calibrated so that if you pull from the good decks over time, you will win money. And we interpret paying attention to which decks are good, that is drawing from the good decks, is sensitivity to potential rewards. That's why you're looking for them. And paying attention to the bad decks shows sensitivity to potential costs if you're avoiding drawing from those decks. And what you see is that adults' behavior over the course of the task changes both in terms of pulling from the good decks more and more and avoiding the bad decks more and more. But now, if you look over here at the younger participants, what you see is that their change in their performance is almost entirely driven by an increase in their pulls from the good decks and not at all driven by their avoidance of the bad decks. And this is consistent with our idea that adolescents become increasingly sensitive to reward during the early adolescent period. Now, with funding from the Jacobs Foundation, And in collaboration with Ken and with Jen Lansford and our team of international investigators, we are replicating this exact study in these parts of the world. Very, very different places. Ultimately, we will have tested about 5,200 people. And right now, we have data analyzed and processed on about 5,000 of them. And so I'd like to show you some of the findings here. These findings do not include the Durham sample, which is still being tested. So this is a non-US sample on the same tasks that you've seen. And so what we see is actually a pretty similar pattern of findings where the adults are changing their poles of the good dex and the bad dex over the course of the task, and where the younger individuals focus mainly on increasing their poles from the good dex. It's not an identical shape to what we saw in the American sample, but it's pretty similar considering how different these countries are. We also look at reward processing with a temporal discounting task or a delay discounting task, in which we ask for individuals' preference between a smaller reward received sooner versus a larger one received later. And so we start with an offer of something like this. Which would you prefer, $200 today or $1,000 in 6 months? And depending upon the person's answer to the question, we either raise or lower the next offer. So if you were to say $1,000 in 6 months, we would come back and we would say, well, how about $600 today versus $1,000 in 6 months? And we do that, titrating their decisions until they reach a point where the subjective value of the immediate reward is the same as the subjective value of the delayed reward. And in behavioral economics, this is referred to as an indifference point. And we repeat this task with 9 different trials with varying the immediate offers, and we use different time intervals so that we can generate what's called a discount function. And it's generally accepted that a lower amount, a lower indifference point, indicates a stronger need for short-term gratification because you're willing to take less in order to get it sooner. Okay? And so if we look at age differences in indifference point, what we see is that younger adolescents show a stronger preference for immediate reward. Actually, it's quite stronger. And we are seeing this same pattern in the non-US sample as well. So that not only are adolescents more reward sensitive than adults, when they're young adolescents, they're particularly sensitive to immediate rewards. And let me turn now to cognitive control and start with a very simple self-report measure. This is a self-report impulse control scale. And what we see is a gradual increase in self-reported impulse control over time, consistent with the gradual maturation of the prefrontal cortex, which is what, after all, is responsible for impulse control. We measure this behaviorally with a task called the Tower of London. In the Tower of London task, you're presented with this configuration of 3 colored balls and a series of pegs onto which you can move them using the computer mouse. And you are asked to rearrange those balls by moving them onto and then back and forth among the pegs so that they now resemble the goal configuration. The Tower of London task that we use has problems that range in difficulty from those that can be solved in 3 moves to those that take 7 moves to solve. And one of the measures that we look at, in addition to looking at how well the problems are solved, is how long people wait before making their first move. Because if you make a bad first move, you're going to have to undo it. And then you won't be able to solve the problem in the minimum number of moves, and you might risk losing your bonus, or at least that's what you're led to believe might happen. And what we see here is that with age, individuals spend more time before making their first move when the problems are harder. And this pattern is not due to differences in memory abilities or working memory. Even if we control that, we get the exact same pattern. And we interpret this as improvement in either the inclination to or the capacity to plan ahead and control an impulsive move to sort of map out a problem before you approach it. And we're seeing the same pattern in our non-US sample as well. We also administer the Stroop test. I'm sure a lot of you have heard of the Stroop test before. And so you're supposed to press the button that matches the color of the word while ignoring what the word says. And that's very hard to do. It requires what we refer to as the inhibition of a prepotent response. It is another but different aspect of impulse control that is regulated by prefrontal systems. And this is a measure of how well people are at inhibiting that response. And you see an increase with age in response inhibition. In some senses, this should not be that surprising. Prefrontal development occurs around the world. The arousal of the limbic system by puberty occurs around the world. And to the extent that we're capturing some manifestations of those brain changes, we should expect to see them cross-nationally. We shouldn't expect to see the ultimate behaviors that they produce to be identical cross-nationally. So that in the United States, adolescents show a lot of drinking. We don't think in Jordan adolescents are going to show a lot of drinking. They will manifest that lack of impulse control and heightened arousal of the limbic system in ways that are culturally appropriate, let's say, in that particular context. But the underlying processes, we believe, are the same.
You're listening to Big Ideas on RN and to Lawrence Steinberg, an authority on adolescent psychological development. Why do adolescents make the decisions they do? According to Lawrence Steinberg, they have a reward-seeking preference for the immediate, but their self-control is yet to mature. Let's hear more about this.
So it seems to me that one of the tasks of adolescence is balancing arousal and self-control, which are regulated by these two competing different brain systems. Just to sort of simplify this, that during childhood, your limbic system is not as easily aroused. Your regulatory competence is still not mature, but it's mature enough to regulate a less easily aroused reward system or limbic system. During adolescence, the first part of adolescence in particular, because of puberty and the impact of puberty on the brain, your limbic system becomes much more easily aroused. Your regulatory system still has not, kind of, if you will, caught up with it. And so this tips the balance toward arousal. So here's the general model that we work with here. At the neurobiological level, we believe that we are studying processes that indicate reward sensitivity and cognitive control. That is manifested psychologically in things like sensation seeking and self-regulation. And those together influence risk-taking. But notice that I've situated risk-taking in a more general context of decision-making and situated that in a cultural context. Another part of our model that's important is that we believe that development of the limbic system is primarily dependent on puberty, whereas development of the cognitive control system is primarily independent of puberty. And we're in the process of conducting some analyses to look at that. But in general, our measures of reward sensitivity are more strongly correlated with pubertal maturation than are our measures of cognitive control. I also think, although I have no evidence for this, that hasn't stopped me ever, I also think that cognitive control is more amenable to intervention and more susceptible to environmental influence. I don't think that there's very much we can do to turn down the arousal of the limbic system, because I think it happens because of the hormonal changes of puberty. So these are data from the children of the National Longitudinal Study of Youth, which is a sample of 7,000 Americans that represents the American population. And this is an analysis that looks at self-reported impulse control and sensation seeking in this sample. And what you see here is that sensation seeking follows, this is a significant curvilinear trend, an inverted U-shaped function, just like we find in our data. By the way, I should say that the size, you know, and the pattern exactly is of course going to vary. The measures are different. What's important to me is sort of the general principle here, that sensation seeking increases during the beginning of adolescence and then declines during the end of adolescence. And we see this gradual improvement in impulse control over time. And we have actually calculated when the difference between these two lines is the greatest, and it is during the mid-adolescent years, around the time of heightened risk-taking. I'm often asked about gender differences. It's always women who ask about that because they know that they perform superiorly on these kinds of measures. And there are a couple things I want to point out here. The first is that at every age, females are better than males at impulse control and are less likely to report sensation-seeking. That's point one. Point two is that the patterns of the lines look really similar between males and females. That is, in both genders, sensation-seeking follows a inverted U-shaped pattern, and impulsivity in general follows a kind of linear increase. That's point two. Point three is that in both sexes, the point of biggest difference between the two lines is at the same age. Okay? So when people ask, how do your findings differ for males and females, I think the answer, and this is true for most of what I've shown you already, is that there are significant main effects, typically indicating greater maturity among females than males. No surprise to women in the audience. But we never see age by sex interactions in our patterns. Okay? Now I want to turn to some newer work that we're very excited about on the impact of peers on adolescent risk-taking. So we know that as people get older, they become better able to resist their friends' encouragement to do things that they shouldn't be doing. This is a self-report measure of resistance to peer influence, and we see, this is from the American sample, a sort of steady improvement over time. One thing that I think is surprising to some people is that this is still improving here in late adolescence. So it's not simply just young adolescents, but it's an improvement over time. And in the non-US sample, we see a very similar pattern with people reporting being better able to resist their peers as they get older. One thing about adolescent risk-taking that's interesting to us is that adolescent risk-taking usually occurs with peers. I mean, sexual risk-taking by definition occurs with someone else. I don't think that you can engage in individual sexual risk-taking. That's probably not very risky. Most experimentation with alcohol and illicit drugs occurs with peers. I found a study that looked at this issue in Italy, a country which is supposedly famous for having adolescents' introduction to alcohol being in the family environment. That turns out to be a myth. Most Italian adolescents have their first taste of alcohol when they're with their friends, not when they're at home. The risk of a serious automobile accident significantly increases with the presence of same-age passengers if the teenager is a driver. And we know from crime data that adolescents are much more likely than adults to commit crimes in groups. These are data on automobile crashes as a function of age and the number of passengers in the car. What you see here is that the presence of additional people in the car dramatically increases the risk of an automobile crash for the young adolescent drivers, a little bit for the 18 and 19-year-olds, and not at all for the adults in this sample. These are data that come from the National Crime Victimization Survey, which is a survey that asks victims to report on their experiences in a criminal incident and asks them, interestingly, to report whether there was one or multiple perpetrators and what was the approximate age of the individuals. And what you see here is that group offending is primarily an adolescent business, not so much an adult business. We have studied the peer effect in our lab using a paradigm that we've done in multiple studies in which we ask people to come to our lab and to bring two same-sex, same-age friends with them, and then we randomly assign them to perform our tasks either by themselves or with their friends watching them. Sometimes in the early experiments, the friends were in the same room as the participant, but then we wanted to take this into the fMRI environment and found it really hard to squeeze all those kids into the magnet at once. So we had to develop a procedure by which the friends could watch the subject's performance from an adjacent room on a monitor and could say hello to the subject so that the subject knew when she or he was being watched. But that was the extent of the communication that they were allowed. One of the tasks that we've used in this kind of design is a stoplight task. Anyone who drives has been in this situation, I'm sure, in which you are trying to get someplace in a hurry, and you come to an intersection, and the light turns yellow, and you make a decision about whether to run that light or not. And I'm sure that everybody, at least everybody in here who's willing to be honest, would admit to have sometimes made the wrong decision in that situation. So the game is set up to mimic that. You're told that there are three things that can happen to you. You can put on the brakes at the intersection, and you lose some time off the clock. Remember, you want to get there as fast as possible to get your bonus payment. You can run the intersection, and you don't lose any time off the clock. Or you can enter the intersection and crash into a car that's crossing through. There's a very loud noise of breaking glass and screeching tires and so on. And you lose twice as much time off the clock as if you had put the brakes on and waited for the light to cycle around. What we found was that when adolescents performed this game by themselves, they crashed the car about the same frequency as adults did. But as soon as we put their friends in the room with them, what we see is that it doubles the number of crashes for adolescents, but increases it marginally for college-age undergraduates, and does not affect adults at all. So the presence of peers seems to, increases risk-taking behavior. Now, in this task, the driving task, you have no idea whether the intersection is going to be a dangerous one or not. Right? The game is programmed so that some of them are and some of them aren't, but you never know. Many times in life, we take risks, but we know at least a little bit about the likelihood of something bad happening. And so we wanted to see if the peer effect appeared when we gave adolescents information about the probability of something bad happening. So we developed this probabilistic gambling task in which we create these little wheels of fortune, and they're divided up into segments that indicate a win, which is green, a loss, which is red, or no outcome change at all, which is gray. And we can manipulate this to present information to the adolescent about the likely probability of winning or losing. And the question was, is the peer effect the same when we give adolescents information about the chances of something bad happening? And the task involves simply deciding whether to bet a token on a particular wheel. You see the wheel, you're asked if you'd like to bet, the wheel starts to spin around, and then it lands and you're shown the outcome. And we do this again either in the presence of peers or alone. These are data from 15 to 17 year old adolescents. And what we find, interestingly enough, is that the peer effect is actually stronger when the risk is greater. Now that's partly because almost everybody bets if the risk is low. But the point, I guess, is that even when an adolescent knows that the chances of something bad happening are better than 50-50, the presence of peers influences the decision to take the chance. I think this is important from a policy point of view because so much of the education that we aim at adolescents to deter their risk behavior sort of emphasizes how likely it is for bad things to happen. But if in fact that doesn't matter when you're with your friends, and if adolescents are with their friends a lot, then that might not be a very effective approach to health education. And you know what? The health education that we do is completely ineffective, more or less. Importantly, in the fMRI environment, what we found is that you see different patterns of brain activation in adolescents when their friends are watching them than when they're alone. But you see no differences in brain activation among adults when they're being observed by their friends versus being alone. The area of activation that you see when friends are watching corresponds to reward centers of the brain, the ventral striatum and the orbital frontal cortex. So that led us to theorize that the mechanism through which peers influence adolescent risk-taking is by increasing adolescents' reward sensitivity, which then makes them focus on the potential reward of a risky choice and pay less attention to the potential costs. And in the driving study, what we found was that the extent to which there was a ventral striatum increase in activation predicted whether the individual ran the yellow light or did not. So that seems to be an important part of the underlying neural mechanism. You recall that we found that with age, there is a decline in preference for immediate rewards. And what I've done here is just pull the data for the 14 and 15-year-old groups and the 18 and 21-year-old groups. But this is the indifference point that we saw in that study. So we repeated this study with college undergraduates, either with or without their friends watching them. And lo and behold, what we find, which many people on college campuses know, is that if you put college undergraduates in a group, you can make them behave like 14-year-olds. And so what we see here is that the presence of peers increases preference for immediate reward in this late adolescent group. Now, this is important, I think, for a couple of reasons. Maybe the main one being that this is not a risk-taking task. There's no risk involved. We just asked about your preference. This is a reward processing task. And remember that our hypothesis is that peers change the way that adolescents process and attend to rewards. And this is consistent with that account. We've just finished and are now writing up an experiment in which we have another reward processing task. It's a high-low guessing game, so you're shown a cue, and you're explained what these cues mean. It has to do with how much you're going to win if you're correct. And there's a cue that shows some of the coins colored in gold and some in gray. It turns out that in this experiment, the magnitude of the cue did not matter. What mattered was whether you were expecting a reward or not expecting a reward. So you're shown this cue. You're told that there's going to be a card. You just have to simply guess whether that card is going to have a number that's higher or lower than the number 5. And then you're shown the outcome. Okay? You all get the idea? So this is, again, a reward processing task. There's no risk involved. You're not betting. You're just kind of guessing. So there's nothing to lose on this. And so what we see here is that the presence of peers increases adolescents' activity in the ventral striatum, but has no effect on adults at all, consistent with what we saw in the driving task, although this is not a risk-taking test, so that's an important part of this. And we see this in the right ventral striatum as well. So we see the peer effect, again, on reward processing in adolescents and not in adults, consistent with the theory that we're developing. So there are a number of possible explanations for why peers have this effect on adolescents and why risk-taking is more likely to occur when adolescents are with their friends. We know that adolescents do everything more with their friends than adults do. And so perhaps risk-taking is just one of many activities that's more common when adolescents are with other people. But we can rule that out because of the experimental design. So we're controlling whether they're with their friends or not by randomly assigning them to that condition. We can rule out the notion that they're encouraging each other to behave in certain ways because in our fMRI experiments, they're not allowed to communicate with each other. So there's no explicit encouragement. They're not putting pressure on each other to take risks because we get the peer effect even when it's just reward processing and there's no risk involved. So one hypothesis that people have advanced about this work is, well, look, even though their friends aren't telling them what to do, you know, adolescents know what their friends are expecting them to do. And they're just trying to behave in ways that are going to please or impress their friends. And so we thought, what if we did this study with adolescents who were incapable of knowing whether their friend, what thinking about the mental processes of other people? Right? So we want to find a sample of adolescents that can't imagine what their friends want them to do. So we did this experiment with mice. So what we did was we created peer groups of mice. So we took mice, and after they were weaned, we created these groups of 3 mice each from a different litter, and they grew up together in a cage. And then out of this whole sample of mice, we tested half of them when they were adolescents and half of them when they were adults. And within each age group, we tested half of them alone and half of them when they were with their peers. Okay, so we basically are replicating the human experimental design, but with rodents instead. And the test that we used was how much alcohol would a mouse drink if given unlimited access to the substance. Do we take the mice, either alone or with their two friends, and we put them in a cage where there are four sipper cups of ethanol solution? This is a species of mouse that likes to drink. It's the species that's used in research on the impact of alcohol on brain development. And, you know, again, we did this with half of the mice when they were adolescents and half of the mice when they were adults. And here's what we find, that when in the presence of peers, adolescent mice drink more alcohol than they do when they're alone, but in the presence of peers, adults drink the same amount as when they're alone. We coded to see whether this is due to activity in general, and it's not. And it doesn't appear to be due to mimicking behavior either. It does have something to do with the way in which being with individuals your own age affects your sensitivity to and processing of rewards. So we think that maybe this is a hardwired feature of adolescence that has been conserved over time. It makes a lot of evolutionary sense that during a time in which you're supposed to find same-aged individuals with whom to mate, being around them should make you feel good and make you reward sensitive. So to summarize, and then briefly talk about some implications, that risk-taking in adolescence, we think, is the product of a maturational imbalance between two different brain systems, an incentive processing system, which is localized mainly in areas of the limbic system, and a cognitive control system, which is localized mainly in the prefrontal cortex. And they develop along different timetables, so that the accelerator is activated before a good braking system is in place. And what peers do, we think, is by stimulating the brain's reward centers, peers actually increase this maturational imbalance. They make an already aroused limbic system even more aroused. Right? It's like why we find funny movies funnier when we watch them with other people. All right? And we think that these are hardwired features of adolescence. Adolescent risk-taking is really hard to stop because it's normative. It's normative because in mammals, all of whom go through puberty, juveniles are expected or forced to leave the family environment in which they were raised and venture out into the wild. And that is a risky proposition because there are predators and there are competitors. So it would make sense from an evolutionary point of view that we might be genetically programmed to be more risk tolerant during adolescence than during other points in development, so that we will engage in this behavior. And if this is the case, it presents a huge challenge to those of us who try to come up with interventions to get adolescents to do the things that are harming them, because we're fighting against something that may be hardwired and evolutionarily adaptive. Shakespeare suggested that we just put people in a stage of suspended animation for a period between 10 and 23. This recognition about adolescence is not new. The neuroscience helps to explain it in a way that wasn't possible 15 years ago. But adolescents have been described for a very long time as being impetuous and impulsive and willing to engage in crazy behaviors. What our research shows is that we now have a better understanding of what is going on underneath all of this. And in fact, today we come up with solutions that are similar to Shakespeare's, but phrased in a different language. And I think that a lot of concern has been raised about the fact that the parts of the adolescent brain are still maturing, and what should we do in light of that? And so here are some practical implications: that adolescent's risky behavior is not due to cognitive deficits. It's not due to bad thinking or to a lack of information. And yet, our health education efforts are all aimed at remediating the presumed deficiencies in what adolescents know or in how they think. And this is why most of them don't work, because they're not addressing the fundamental cause of the risky behavior. It's not insufficient information or poor thinking. So we've suggested that maybe we ought to rethink this and think about changing the context rather than trying to change the teenager. So to make it less likely that teens will be in harm's way, let me give you some examples of successful interventions that have done this. Raising the price of cigarettes has done more to diminish teen smoking than any health education effort has ever done. Graduated driver's licensing, which you have here in North Carolina, has done more to reduce teenage automobile fatalities than any driver's education program has ever done. It's been demonstrated that adolescent binge drinking is correlated with the density of retail outlets in an area in which a high school is located. We can regulate those kinds of things. We can make it more difficult for adolescents to get their hands on substances that we don't want them to get their hands on, rather than simply telling them that it's bad to use those substances. After-school programs for adolescents that keep them in healthy, structured, adult-supervised activities is another kind of intervention that's changing the context. We know from plenty of research that unstructured, unsupervised time with peers is a recipe for risk-taking during adolescence. And yet, we have our kids' lives structured so that from 3 o'clock in the afternoon until 6 o'clock in the evening, most of them are in unstructured, unsupervised settings. And that's now the most common time of day for experimentation with drug and alcohol and sex. Now, I also think that it's important that we provide opportunities for healthy risk-taking. Not all risk-taking is bad. And, you know, we can't stop it from happening anyway, that's my point, because it's normative. Now, I don't know, and we don't know, whether providing opportunities for healthy risk-taking will diminish adolescents' inclination to engage in unhealthy risk-taking. But it seems to me that, given the fact that we know that this is what adolescents enjoy doing, as adults, we can help them engage in this risk-taking behavior in ways that's not going to harm them or other people. And we can also work on building self-control, because as I said before, our hypothesis is that that system can be changed. I say this because we know from lots of research on parenting that different parenting practices are associated with individual differences in self-regulation and self-control. We know from research from people like Ken Dodge that we can develop programs that help kids improve their ability to regulate their impulses. So perhaps we can focus more on interventions that help build self-regulation. We're not going to be able to affect the reward processing system, but perhaps we can help develop the cognitive control system. And until we do that, though, I think it's important to provide external control until self-control is mature. And that's why we want to help teach parents to monitor their teenagers, and why we want to encourage school districts to have healthy after-school activities where kids are monitored and supervised by adults. And to recognize, in fact, that the maturation of internal control comes from exposure to external control. It's paradoxical and it's counterintuitive, but it's been demonstrated. And I think we can think collectively about how best to do this in ways that acknowledge that adolescence is what it is, and that by changing the context in which kids live, we can be more successful at reducing adolescent risk-taking than by trying to make teenagers into something that they're not.
That lecture was part of the Sulzberger Distinguished Lecture Series at Duke University. Your speaker was Lawrence Steinberg, Distinguished University Professor and Laura H. Carnell Professor of Psychology at Temple University. You can find a link to the slides which he used in this lecture on our website. Just go to abc.net.au/radionational and find the Big Ideas site.